If we go to the ballet, I have no clue what I'm looking at. I can't tell what's coming next. I only know things as they happen. And even when they did, I have no idea what they mean. But I can go into a workshop that's manufacturing that Japanese temple. And like, I have a good sense as to what I'm looking at, how these pieces are going to put themselves together. So I've always been fascinated in that creation process where you go from raw material to something else.
Hey everybody, I'm your host Stephen Pulverin, and this is Hodinkee Radio. By now, if you're a regular listener, you'll know that I love having guests on the show who can't be boiled down to just a simple label, and this week's guest is a perfect example of that. Adam Morelli's an artist, he's a photographer, he's a builder, he's a philosopher, he's a craftsman, and of course, he's a watch lover. But he's also a friend, he's somebody I've known for a while, and somebody who I always enjoy talking to about big ideas and the ways that we find meaning in the little things. It was a ton of fun to finally have him on the show and sit down and chat about things like what defines culture, what makes it so difficult to pin down, why Zen philosophy has helped Adam find a center, and how he ended up a watch enthusiast after reading a book about John Harrison. We also dig into some big and sort of controversial questions, but you're going to have to listen on to hear that. Before my chat with Adam, though, I sit down with our own editor-in-chief, Mr. Jack Forrester, to talk about some of the recent stories he's written for the site. Specifically, I'm interested in some of these big, winding, in-depth pieces about things like how the modern watch escapement came to be, the pros and cons of different types of travel watches, and what horological history could have been like if just one or two tiny things changed. These stories are about as Jack as a story can get, and I think they're really quintessential Hodinkee stories. So, without further ado, let's do this. This week's episode is presented by Accutron and the Accutron Show podcast. In addition to relaunching the iconic mid-century watch brand, Accutron has produced a new podcast focused on bringing you a new generation of conversations for the 21st century. Stay tuned later in the show to learn more or visit AccutronWatch.com. Hey, Jack. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, Stephen. It's a pleasure to be back on the show.
It's been a busy couple weeks at the Dank, hasn't it?
It certainly has. Anybody who thought that this was going to be a slow year, where were they wrong? I mean, I kind of thought it was going to be honest, a few months ago, but we haven't taken our foot off the gas pedal, and neither has the watch industry.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, I feel like every summer we think like, oh, Switzerland's going to shut down. It's going to be quiet, whatever. And it never happens. And this year I had this like vague hope that like maybe that would be true. With everything going on, you know, I was like, oh, maybe there will be a little bit of a lull. We can catch our breath, plan some long-term stuff, whatever. No, that's clearly not the case.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I think things did slow down a little bit in the earlier part of the year, but a lot of these brands, a lot of the companies in Switzerland in general, you know, they really seem to feel like, okay, we're not going to wait an entire year to make major product announcements. And, you know, lest we forget, they've had this stuff in the pipeline that they're showing now. It's been under development for anywhere from, depending on what it is, 2 to 7 years.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. And I mean, people who want detailed product stuff, like, go visit the site. We'll do kind of a product catch-up on the show soon. But, you know, there are some more releases imminent as we record this that we want to include in that discussion. So I wanted to talk about, you've kind of gone back to the well here and done some, like, vintage old school Jack Forrester deep dives in the last couple of weeks, and it's been a lot of fun. I mean, it's like we spend so much time on this like product cycle where we're like hamsters on a wheel just trying to keep up with what's new, and the fact that you've managed to find the time to like dig back into the archive and not just the archive of product, but like really look at the sort of longer history of watchmaking and what it means is, I think, really fascinating and really valuable for people.
Well, thank you, Stephen. I have to say, probably most of my better ideas for stories actually come from reading comments on articles that we publish and seeing what people are kind of curious about, what they'd like to know more about. sometimes seeing where the knowledge gaps are that people themselves might not be aware of. And, you know, having a chance to sort of hear a little bit more from readers, I think has been very helpful for me in terms of getting a handle on what it is that people might be interested in hearing about. So some of the stuff that I've been doing, some of the less product focused stuff, it's really been about trying to figure out what people would genuinely like to know more about and trying to put it together in a way that's interesting and engaging, even for folks who might know a little bit about the subject, but certainly for folks who might not know that much about the subject.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the things that sets your stories apart is, like, it's really hard to know enough to write these stories. Like, there's so much back knowledge that's required. Like, we couldn't just assign one of these stories to anybody and have anybody kind of, like, take 2 or 3 days and figure it out. But at the same time, you do a really good job kind of translating that knowledge in a way that, you know, somebody who maybe doesn't know much about watch escapements, which is the first thing we're going to talk about, can dig into this and I think come away with it feeling like they know something. But at the same time, the, like, real movement nerds still feel like they've been done justice, which, if there's anything movement nerds love, it's being done justice, right?
Yeah, I think that's probably a universal human failing. You know, it is funny. I was thinking about this the other night. I started reading A.A. Gill's autobiography, the late British food restaurant critic and wide-ranging writer on other subjects as well. A.A. Gill, who passed away a little while ago from pancreatic cancer, I believe. And one of the things that he says in his autobiography is that he feels really lucky to have gotten interested in writing about restaurants when he became interested in writing about restaurants, because, you know, it wasn't that long ago that chefs were not the media superstars they are today, and where, yeah, you know, food writing didn't command the kind of interest that it commands today. And, you know, if I decided to become a watch journalist 40 or 50 years ago, I think it would have been much more difficult. You know, watches are talked about, looked at, read about to a much, much higher level nowadays than I think certainly in my entire lifetime. The level of curiosity that's there is really incredible. And I feel like we're pretty lucky to have decided to become watch writers, coincidentally at a time when there's a real groundswell of interest in watches, fine watchmaking, and watch history, because I'd probably be still making, you know, 25 cents a word writing for periodicals with, you know, 5,000 person circulations that nobody's heard of if it weren't for that.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. I want to make sure we dig right into the stories to have the time. But while we're talking about A.A. Gill, what's that Parisian restaurant that he absolutely eviscerated?
Oh, best restaurant review ever. It's L'Ami Louis. He ends his story by saying, "It is, entre nous, all things considered, the worst restaurant in the world."
Amazing. We'll link up to that. Yes. I remember you sent me this review years ago, and I'd never seen it. Like, it's probably like 5-6 years ago now.
It's hilarious.
It's incredible.
It's hilarious. Do we have time for one? We have time for one quick quote.
Yeah, you can quote it. Sure. I can't bring it up and then not let you quote it.
The kidneys en brochette look like suppurating rat babies recovered from a nuclear reactor accident. They don't taste as nice as they sound.
Oh, that's such good writing, man. It's terrible sounding food, but it's such good writing. All right. So speaking, here's my wonderful segue. Speaking of great writing, Jack. So you wrote this story for the site. The headline's "In Depth: The Modern Watch Escapement and How It Got That Way." And then in maybe my favorite thing you've done all year, you ironically quoted yourself in the deck, in the subhead. "An interest in escapements is a sign of horological maturity." Jack Forrester, quoted by Jack Forrester.
I'm surprised I didn't get more flack for that, actually.
I literally, like, this sounds like I'm making this up. Like, I literally giggled at my keyboard when I saw this. Just, like, it showed up. I had not seen this when it was in draft. I did not edit this story. And, like, I only saw it when it went live. And, like, I got the push notification, pulled it up on my phone, saw it, and just sat here in front of my computer giggling. I loved it. But, I mean, the main gist of this story is that the escapement is, A, super important, B, far more interesting than lots of people give it credit for, and C, a thing that, like, if you're really going to be into watches, you kind of need to know at least a little bit about, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really it. The gist of the story was that a lot of the stuff, probably 99% of the stuff that we talk about when we talk about watches, is cosmetics. We talk about, you know, a case design, we talk about dial colors, we talk about the configuration of the hands, and we talk about condition, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But if you start to go past appearances, and appearances are important, you know, I mean, retailers say that, I don't know what the saying is, that 90% of selling a watch is having a dial that people like looking at. Which is perfectly natural because that's mostly what we experience. We don't directly experience the mechanism. But for me, it really makes wearing a watch and being interested in mechanical watches much richer to have a sense of how they work. And the thing that I tried to dig into in this particular story was that, you know, a watch is really an attempt to solve a very, very difficult problem in practical physics. But you can't tell time with a mechanical device without having some sort of an oscillator. And ideally, you know, there's the mathematical formula for a simple harmonic oscillator. It's not complicated. Anybody with high school algebra can understand it. But the problem is oscillators don't operate under ideal circumstances. They are damped, as the saying goes in physics, by lots and lots of things. Gravity and friction, changes in temperature can affect how well an oscillator runs. You know, all of the things in the external environment that we don't want to have to think about when we put on a watch. We actually pay a lot of money when we're paying for a good watch, for one that can ignore the environment as much as possible. But all of these things are factors that watchmakers really struggled with over the centuries, just figuring out what to do about the effect of temperature on the diameter of the balance and on the elasticity of the balance spring. That was a couple of centuries gone. And some of the finest minds in practical physics in the world worked on these problems. And, you know, you get into that a little bit, you find out a little bit more about it, and you really start to see your watch as quite this miraculous little thing.
No, that's very true. And I think, you know, the thing you mentioned there at the end is worth hammering home, is that, you know, today we think of mechanical watches and mechanical timekeeping as a luxury, as a hobby. But for centuries, this was like crucial to everything. It was crucial to the growth and fall of empires, and there were the best minds in the world were focused on these problems in a way that today there are many, many brilliant people in the watchmaking world, but like, you know, your star, you know, quantum physicist is likely not going to end up working at one of the watch companies that you know about, right?
Yeah, I mean, the stuff that's relevant for navigation in the mid-1700s, you know, when John Harrison and people like Ferdinand Berthoud were plying their trade. And you know, to your point, Stephen, and we've talked about this on the show before, the truth is, for a couple of centuries there, if you didn't have an accurate sea clock, you did not have a blue water navy. You had a coastal you had a coastal merchant marine. You couldn't be a major trading empire. And nowadays, of course, all of that stuff, you know, navigation, this stuff is being handled by people like the physicists at NIST, who work on atomic clocks that are accurate to within 1 second every 13 or 14 billion years. So that's kind of where that's kind of where that game is now from a practical standpoint. And it's amazing how quickly that's happened. You know, I mean, World War II battleships were still going to sea with marine chronometers and sextants. So this is all stuff that's happened in the last 75 years or so.
I want to take a stab here, and this will be a great chance for me to show how much I do or don't know here, and a chance for you to either pat me on the back or correct me embarrassingly in front of everyone on air. But To boil this down, I mean, it took me legitimately years, and I think I'm a decently smart human being, but it took me years of looking at watch movements all the time to like really understand how they work, and not at like a superficial level where I'm like, oh, it has a balance wheel, it moves back and forth, and like that's how the watch runs, you know, but to like really kind of have a handle on it. And so to boil this all down, you know, we're focused on the escapement here. Ultimately, what the escapement does is it is what takes the power in the, you know, in the barrels and mets it out in the right increments so as to move the hands at the speed necessary to keep time effectively, correct?
That's exactly correct. That's exactly correct.
Okay.
You know,
if you don't have an escapement and you wound a watch or clock up and it was, you know, built as best it could be without an escapement, but with, you know, the right transfer of power, the moment you let go of that crown or that winding key, the hands would just start spinning uncontrollably, right? Without an escapement to kind of dampen that and count out time.
Yeah, that's exactly correct. And in fact, it would be you know, there's an awful lot of kinetic energy stored in the mainspring of, say, an 8-day clock. And one of those things, if it has a fully wound mainspring and it breaks, it's an explosive event. There's a lot of energy released all at once. And even in a watch, you end up, you know, breaking things, snapping teeth off gears in the going train. I mean, we've all played with wind-up toys, and I think we've all had, you know, the experience of winding up a wind-up toy, and, you know, they don't have the most robust mainsprings in the world. When one of them gives out, you hear this horrible, high-pitched grinding noise, and the winding key for the toy starts to spin like crazy, and never, ever afterwards will your little toy robot or ducky walk across the living room rug again.
That's true, yeah.
But, you know, you're 100% correct. The simplest description of a mechanical watch or clock is that it is a device for measuring how fast the mainspring unwinds.
Great. Love that. Also, I'm glad that I got that right, because it means today will not be my last day at Hodinkee, which is great.
Oh, and by the way, you know, to your other point, it's not actually all that easy to understand how even a simple watch works. It's not a complicated machine, but it doesn't work like anything else that we usually encounter on a daily basis, certainly not anymore. So kind of get your, you know, kind of wrapping your mind around how an anchor escapement works or Swiss lever escapement works. It's not the most intuitive thing on earth.
Yeah. And it gets even more complicated when you start adding layers to it, right? Like, you know, the Swiss lever escapement is one thing. A Deton escapement is one thing. But one of the things that you outline in this story is the fact that there's actually been a decent amount of escapement innovation in the last couple of years. And by couple of years, I mean really a couple of decades. But in the span of time that we're talking about the evolution of horology, you know, folks like Grand Seiko, folks like Daniels, like people are really, really pushing on this. Like, it's a thing people are still working to innovate on, despite the fact that, like, the technology that, you know, 99% of mechanical watches use is a couple hundred years old.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. There's been a lot of research. There's been a lot of prototyping, and there's been a lot of small series production of unusual escapements. But to actually, and all of that stuff is fascinating. You know, the Girard Perregaux constant escapement, which is a constant force escapement, which relies on the flexibility of silicon blade springs. Now, this is something that a lot of people have experimented with, including Zenith more recently, over the last 20 or so years. And it's a really cool thing to look after. It tends to remain a bit of a niche field of research. So coming up with a novel escapement is already pretty difficult, but coming up with a novel escapement that is as good or better than a well-made Swiss lever escapement seems to be next to impossible based on the evidence of the past 20 years. And, you know, the Daniels coaxial is, I wouldn't call it a variation on the lever escapement, but it certainly draws on aspects of the lever escapement in order for it to do what it does, as well as aspects of the chronometer escapement. So, you know, the escapements that I covered in that story, there's the Daniels coaxial, there's the Swiss lever escapement, there's the Rolex Chronergy escapement. We have a new high beat escapement from Grand Seiko, which is only deployed in a limited series so far, although my guess is they're going to deploy that one more widely in years to come. You know, and that's kind of it. Audemars Piguet had the AP direct impulse escapement that came out, I think, in 2006, and that has resisted industrialization as well. Can I tell you a quick story about the coaxial?
Yeah, please do.
So it was a conversation that I had with a guy, senior executive at Omega many years ago, a few years after they launched the coaxial. And I said, is it driving sales for you? And he said, no, almost not at all. And I said, really? And he said, look, in order for you to get excited enough about the coaxial escapement to buy a coaxial watch, first you have to know the difference between a mechanical watch and a quartz watch. Then you have to know that a mechanical watch has a thing in it called an escapement. Then you have to know what a lever escapement is and how it works. Then you have to know the disadvantages of the lever escapement. Then you have to know about the chronometer escapement, and you have to know about the advantages and disadvantages of the chronometer escapement. Then you have to understand how much insight it took to put together an escapement that has the advantages of the lever and the chronometer escapement and the disadvantages of neither. And at this point, you're down to about six people on Earth.
I like that. That's some nice self-aware reflection from somebody up at the top.
Yeah, I don't get the impression that they regret industrializing the escapement. There are certainly performance and service advantages that it gives Omega. Plus, it makes their movements absolutely distinctive from everybody else's. But I thought it was a fair point.
Yeah. Well, the last thing I want to touch on before we move on is, I mean, you said it has to be better than a previous escapement, not just different. And I think that's an important thing is, like, you're not just building a different mousetrap, you're building a better mousetrap. And additionally, it doesn't just have to provide better chronometry. It also has to be able to be built in most cases, unless you're, you know, Roger Smith or Kari Voutilainen, right? Like, it needs to be built at some level of scale. It needs to be serviceable. It needs to be reliable. Like, it's there are lots of problems to be solved here in addition to just, like, pure timekeeping capabilities that make this a really multifaceted problem.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's it has to be not just as good as, but better, as you said. And that's tough, man. You know, the lever escapement's been around since 1755 for a reason.
Yeah. All right. Let's move on to another rich area of development, which is travel watches. So you wrote this other story just because the pros and cons of the different types of travel watches. When I first got into mechanical watches, I'll admit travel watches were kind of my entry point. I was in college. I didn't travel all that much. I mean, I studied abroad, but, like, I didn't really travel all that much. I aspired to travel a lot. I'm very fortunate that now in this line of work, I do get to travel a lot when the world is open. And travel watches always seem to me to just, they carry this sort of spirit and this sense of aspiration and optimism with them. And there's just something so beautiful and poetic about them. So I was really excited to see when you dropped this story. What is it about travel watches, kind of before we get into the specifics, that you find appealing?
I mean, what I love about the whole category is they just fire up the imagination. You know, you look at or put on a watch like a Patek World Timer, a Rolex GMT Master, or, you know, really pretty much any multi-time zone watch. And you just start thinking about where you'd like to go, you know, about what the experience is like of getting on an airplane. And, you know, a few hours later, you find yourself thousands, maybe tens of thousands of miles away from where you started. It makes you think about the world in a different way. And every watch, I think every watch has that, you know, capability. It lets you sort of live in a world in your imagination that you wouldn't necessarily live in otherwise. And, you know, travel watches are part of the biggest dream of all, which I think is the dream of exploring, the dream of seeing the world. It's so deeply, deeply ingrained in human character to explore. We just don't seem to be able to help ourselves. For better or worse, we don't seem to be able to help ourselves. But I think that's what travel watches speak to. There's a fantastic, fantastic book by Bruce Chatwin that I read years and years ago when I was in college called The Songlines. And his thesis in the book is basically that human beings are unhappy if they don't walk a certain amount. You know, we're an inherently peripatetic species. We're born travelers. And on a really, really profound level, I think that's what travel watches speak to. New horizons, you know?
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And I think that speaks to something about watches more generally, which is now that the mechanical wristwatch doesn't really have a sort of, like, functional, it is not a functional necessity. I won't say it doesn't have a functional purpose. It does, but it's not a necessity. These things have the ability to captivate our imaginations and to make us want to be different and to make us push ourselves and to make us see ourselves in different ways. And I think, like you said, travel watches do that really acutely. And I wonder, you know, we won't walk through all of the types of travel watches here because people can just go read the article, which we'll link up in the notes. But what is your favorite category of travel watches that you talked about here?
Okay, so I notoriously chicken out when asked questions like this. I seem to be incapable of writing an entry for our editors' roundups and picking an honest favorite. If you go back and look at the ones that I've written, and they all start out, well, there's so many I love. They're all so wonderful. It's really hard to pick one. but it is.
That's fair.
It's hard
to
pick one.
I got you.
I love them all. Practically speaking, I have found that what James Stacy likes to call flyer GMT watches, for me, are the ones that work best when I travel because you just you reset the hour hand when you land. You don't have to stop the watch. I have never in my life traveled anywhere that has less than a full hour offset from GMT, although if I did, I probably would find myself slightly annoyed by the way that all so-called flyer watches are set up. But, you know, going from I go mostly to Europe, every once in a while to Japan, you know, like you said, when the world is open, China once in a blue moon. And all of those places, a flyer GMT just works. I look at it and I know instantly without having to do any mental acrobatics what local time is and what home time is. And there's nothing I love more than a true world timer. And you can get them in an enormous, I mean, I talked about the Patek world timer in the story, but of course there's great world timers from other brands like Montblanc, which are much, much more affordable. I mean, more affordable than Patek Philippe world timer, admittedly, is not setting the bar terribly high, but you know, yeah, more affordable.
I wasn't going to give you a hard time about that, but yes, fair.
But at the same time, I feel like for most travelers from a practical standpoint, a flyer GMT is probably the easiest to live with and the easiest to understand. You know, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, you're jet lagged, you've had to go to meetings all day and, you know, maybe a couple of events in the evening, and you just don't want to have to think too hard when you look at your watch to see if it's still okay to call the family.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. And I owned a Rolex GMT Master, a vintage one. I know you've owned one as well. And while it's not, if we're talking about true vintage ones, it's not a flyer GMT where the hand itself is adjustable, but you get a similar result with the adjustable bezel. And there really is just something so nice and easy about that. And it's sort of, in a funny way, it sort of makes you feel at home in other places because you don't have that, like, there's something jarring about looking down at your wrist and being like, oh my God, I don't understand what this is. What time is it? Whereas when you look down and it feels familiar, it makes the other place that you're in feel familiar in a way, which I like. I liked your categorization of the, it looks like a world timer, but it's a two time zone watch. Which is funny because this is like a whole, like, this has been a bugaboo of mine for years, are these watches that, like, they have city rings and they sometimes are marketed as world timers, but, like, they're not world timers.
Sometimes they're actually called world timers.
Yeah, sometimes they are. And I mean, props to, you know, the three that you have images of in the story are from JLC, Lange, and Nomos. And none of them market them as world timers. They do all market them as travel watches. But I think there's something fun about these watches, not just because they're travel watches, but also they allow you to kind of dip your toe into the idea of having like a really complicated watch without actually having a really complicated watch, which means A, the prices are a little lower. B, service and upkeep isn't going to be as onerous, you know, like, but you get to kind of dip your toe. Like if you look at this Lange or like the JLC Geographic, like they look like complicated watches. But they're actually extremely functional and practical. And there's something fun for me about that kind of juxtaposition there.
Yeah, actually that particular category was kind of the impetus for the whole story, because every time we run a story about a watch with a city ring, whether it's a world timer or not, the question comes up is, you know, wait a second, is this a real world timer? What's the difference between this and a quote unquote real world timer? So, you know, just another way of sort of saying, how many different ways there are to skin a cat when it comes to creating multi-time zone watches. I got a little bit of flack in the comments from people naturally I could not talk about every single multi-time zone watch out there, much less every single category and subcategory. But there were a few people who felt bad that their favorites had been left out. You know, like it's not in the catalog now, but the Calatrava Dual Time is one of my favorite two-time zone watches. Right. The Saxonia Dual Time is another one. I actually thought about including them as a separate category, but they kind of seemed like basically flyer GMTs to me in that they have independently settable local time hour hands that move in 1 hour increments. I came close to breaking that out as a separate category.
Maybe there's a follow-up story here all about dress travel watches.
Oh, there you go.
All right. So speaking of hypotheticals here, let's move on to the last thing I want to recap, which is from a little longer ago. It's from about a month ago. But when you first brought this idea up, I thought it was like one of the most fun things we've done in a long time. And I was super excited to see you put it together. And that is the story, Just Because, four what ifs that could have changed watchmaking history forever. Welcome to Bizarro World, which is, like, this is the sort of thing that, like, and I'm not trying to, like, blow smoke here, Jack. You know I'm not that kind of guy. But, like, this is just so fun. And it's the sort of thing that, like, only you could have written. Like, this story requires so many strange, interconnected types of knowledge. And also the right mind to be able to draw the connections between those things in a certain way. And like, I really just like can't imagine anybody else having put this together.
I mean, it's a little pathetic. You know, one of the prerequisites for this story is having spent a significant chunk of your childhood trying to catch episodes of Doctor Who on public television. But yeah, it was a lot of fun to put together. You think about these things sometimes, I suppose. You write about watches long enough, you write about any subject long enough, and you start to say to yourself, well, what if, you know, I mean, what if, you know, what if Napoleon had won the Battle of Waterloo or whatever? And in watches and watchmaking, the current horological landscape has been shaped by a lot of macro historical events that usually don't get talked about. So the Huguenot diaspora, the Protestant diaspora from France into Switzerland, had a lot to do with the fact that watchmaking was established in Switzerland as strongly as it was, although there was certainly a clockmaking industry prior to the Protestant diaspora. But, you know, things like that, I started wondering, you know, like, what would Abraham Louis Breguet say if he saw, you know, the status of the tourbillon today? And these things kind of like rolled around in my head for years and years and years. And I finally thought to myself, wouldn't it be fun to put together a story about what would happen if some of the things that have shaped the modern watchmaking landscape had not happened? And then I thought to myself, well, wouldn't it be fun to phrase this in the form of a narrative that kind of includes the reader as a character in the story, you know, a time traveler, a watch enthusiast time traveler who actually goes back and makes the mistake of telling Breguet what's happened to the tourbillon, discouraging him forever from inventing it and making him work to essentially create a company that was a, you know, an 18th century Rolex because he got so fed up with complicated watchmaking. That kind of thing. It was surprisingly difficult to write too. I got about three quarters of the way through it. Well, because, you know, it's like a time travel story, and it turns out, and I say this as a lifelong science fiction fan, it turns out writing a time travel story that doesn't completely lose the reader and become totally implausible halfway through is quite difficult. So this thing went through.
Who knew, Jack?
Yeah, this thing, it actually went through several revisions. In order to make the sort of plot line work. And given more time with it, I probably would have been able to refine it even more. But, you know, I feel kind of like smug about having pulled it off at all. It was a little more difficult than I thought it was going to be.
Which of the four sections? So the four sections here are, you talk Louis XIV into not revoking the Edict of Nantes. Hans Wilsdorf stays in London. Abraham Louis Breguet, inventor of existentialism? And Nicholas G. Hayek sends you back to the future. Which of those four sections was for you the most fun to write?
Oh my gosh. I think the most difficult to write was the one about Wilsdorf, because I think it was really the tax structure in the UK versus the tax structure in Switzerland that made him relocate. And there's just like no way that if there's 10 billion parallel universes in all of them but one, the tax structure in the UK does not change. I think the most fun for me to write was probably the last one, the one involving Nicholas G. Hayek. Mm-hmm. And that was fun for a number of reasons. Number one, I thought it was kind of a neat way to wrap up the whole narrative and kind of reset the timeline. So that was the biggest problem that I had. It was like, how do we reset the timeline to normal? And it was also fun because of all the individuals that you talk to in the story, he's the only one that I ever met in person. And geez, you know, I miss the guy. I really do. He was always such great copy. And he loved talking to the press. And he was profane and opinionated and loved watches. He loved business. He had such an absolute passion for what he was doing and a crazy imagination. You know, this is the guy who took Breguet from a brand that was really, really on the skids and turned it into one of the great modern luxury wristwatch brands, actually went to the trouble of remaking the Marie Antoinette Grand Complication. And I interviewed him maybe a total of three times, three Basel Worlds before he passed away, but he was such a larger than life character. And I miss his eccentricities. Well, I mean, there's still plenty of those in the Swiss watch industry, but I feel
I was going to say,
but you know, it really used to be the what, you know, when people like Mr. Hayek were around and were basically reinventing mechanical horology back in the 90s and the early aughts, man, you had to have a real you had to have a real circus act in order to get people's attention. You know, selling a mechanical watch in the mid-1990s, early 1990s, was not such an easy thing to do. And he had a sense of showmanship. You know, Jean-Claude Biver is the same way, you know, gentlemen of the same generation. And both of them, you know, have a wonderful sense of the showmanship necessary in order to sell mechanical watches. And it was just a ton of fun to write about him as if he were still around.
That's great. Well, I'm going to recommend anybody listening to this, if you haven't read these three stories, they're linked up in the show notes. They're linked up on the post on the site. Go check them out. They're super fun. To me, this is like quintessential Hodinkee stuff here. Thank you for joining us, Jack. Thanks for going through this with me. And I hope you've got more cooking.
Oh, yeah. Always more. As long as there are questions in the comments, I'm going to have ideas for stories.
Talk to you soon.
Thank you, Steve. Good to see you.
Up next, we have my conversation with builder, artist, and photographer Adam Morelli. Hey, Adam, good to see you.
Good to see you too, Stephen.
How you doing?
Good, good.
It's been, I think I saw you not too long before lockdown started, but it feels like 100 years ago by this point.
Everything feels like it was about a decade ago.
I mean, you're like me. You're usually in some like far flung corner of the globe. Have you been staying like basically put in New York City?
For the most part. I mean, we escaped a little bit upstate, a little bit to the beach, but really short stuff. But compared to, I think last year I had 17 trips on the year.
Okay.
So it's probably about a similar something that you're running. So being home for a few months straight just feels, ooh, it feels weird.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure it also like it affects, I mean, we'll get into this, but like you're a photographer who's like bread and butter is being out in the field, like out with people. So I would imagine it impacted your practice there a lot over the last couple months.
It did. I mean, I think one of the things that this lockdown period has given me is a profound appreciation for the ability to go out and socialize with work outside of the studio.
Yeah. I mean, so maybe we start there then. I mean, so you and I, we first met through watches, but you know, we're both photographers and we spend a lot of the time when we hang out talking about photography. You know, you're photography is also a part of kind of a bigger artistic practice. You know, you're also a painter and a builder, you know, but how did you first end up a photographer? How did that start for you?
I started with a camera in university.
Okay.
I grew up in a house with cameras. Both of my parents were, my father had worked for Minolta in his 20s. My mother was an amateur shooter. I mean, there are some really uncomfortably top tier portrait sessions of me in my younger years because they shot a lot. And I think as a result, I had no interest in photography. That was the annoying thing my parents did. And when I got into university, we had to do painting and drawing as the foundations. Sculpture really caught my attention. And the references, like when I wanted to do like field sketches, it started to make sense to use a camera. And one of the professors kind of encouraged me like, well, you can do this as a double concentration. It's weird. We don't have many like sculptor photo, like kind of double majors, but if you want, like you can do it. And that it started as field work for sculpture research.
It's funny. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. I can't really think of too many photographer sculptors, I guess maybe like Hiroshi Sugimoto, but like other than that, like I can't really think of any.
I guess it doesn't come up that much, but for a lot of the things that I've been interested in, the field research, a camera works well. Like it's fine to make underwater paintings, but one doesn't paint underwater. Like the field research, the camera really works much better for that. When I was in school, the aesthetic for a lot of photography was really dry. It was this like sort of Stephen Shore, like Gursky was like a rich character in comparison. Mm-hmm. And a lot, like I remember some of the photo work that like Dan Graham did. Like I remember back in the 90s, Dan Graham had an installation at the top of Dia in Chelsea. And I thought this sculpture was amazing. And then I looked up his photo work and he'd done some photo work in New Jersey. And it was like, I mean, drier than dry. So I figured like, well, if I'm going to do the photo thing, like I might as well learn how to like use the thing, like learn how to use the tool, which
yeah.
from a builder's standpoint or a sculptor's standpoint, like you want to learn how to use an acetylene torch, because if you don't know how to use it, you're entering into a world of problems, like not knowing how to use a radial arm saw. Like there are risks involved.
Right.
Not knowing how to use a camera doesn't really have any risks. It's just the work tends to be kind of limited because you can't get out of the little black box what you want.
And now a word from this week's sponsor. If you've ever watched Mad Men, you'll no doubt remember the iconic scene that firmly establishes that an Accutron watch is not a timepiece.
It's a conversation piece.
Wow, Freddie, that's a home run.
Taking this idea to the next level, Accutron has launched the Accutron Show podcast, featuring in-depth conversations about classic American culture and how it's evolved over time. The weekly podcast is the first from a major watch brand, and it's hosted by a group of fantastic personalities, including entertainment reporter Bill McCuddy, journalist David Graver, and editor Scott Alexander. Each brings their own expertise to the diverse subjects covered on the show, which include cars, whiskey, cigars, travel, pop culture, art, and, of course, watches. Recent episodes have included guests such as La Palina Cigars' Sam Phillips, watch industry veteran Reginald Brack, wine consultant Mika Bulmash, supermodel and actress Carol Alt, and Hudson Whiskey ambassador David Powell. Each episode has its own flavor, its own unique perspectives, and its own surprises. This is a weekly conversation you definitely don't want to miss. For more, visit AccutronWatch.com and subscribe to The Accutron Show wherever you listen to podcasts. All right, let's get back to the show. Like there's sort of like a fetishization of cameras, which is something like I am just as guilty of as everybody else. But like you ultimately, like you need to be able to do a thing with it in a way that like other quote unquote like luxury objects or like, you know, gadgets, you don't necessarily need to. But there's like definitely a learning curve there that's kind of born out of necessity.
Really? I mean, it is. It follows a lot of analog processes. I mean, I think like learning how to drive a car on a manual transmission. Like, you know, I've more recently learned how to ride a motorcycle. I'm not using a quick shifter. I think when you understand how something is supposed to work and you're responsible for all the steps, the thing educates you. It really like it teaches you a lot. And in order to get those two things in sync, which you get them in sync. It's not that hard. But it starts to give you a command over the things that you produce in a way that is hopefully interesting for the people watching. But I'm sure, as you imagine, it's fulfilling on the maker end, where you're like, "Ooh, got it!" Like,
yeah,
and I got it again. Like, and now I'm getting it most of the time.
Right. Yeah, that moment where like a happy accident becomes a thing you can do on demand is where you really know that you like. You've locked it in, like you've got control over it. It's no longer that you're just kind of like riding the wave and hoping for the best.
Sure. I mean, the automatic part doesn't, it's not very fun. Mm. It's more like video games, which I never took I was never really that into. It's very much a simulation of something. And it never tickled me.
That's interesting. I mean, I guess then for you is making art, whether it's a sculpture or a photograph or a painting, is part of the pleasure in doing it kind of like gaining that mastery over the process and then exercising that?
Gaining some proficiency over the making part. I feel like what that does is it gets the clunkiness of me out of the way. That's like the clunkiness is like the physical inability for me to be able to do something. To get to a working point where like I can do with the material what I'd like, it's so that the idea, which is this invisible thing no one can see, and then whatever I output, I'm part of that process, but you're not looking at my stumbling over it. And that's what clunky painting or bad photography is. It's like, it's still me fumbling around in front of you. So I'm not like a real, I don't see myself as like an incredibly technical person. I think my view on making things is a little more macro. Like, I'm a fairly good woodworker. I'm like a decent welder. I can work with glass. I'm pretty good with mold making. I'm pretty good at photography. I'm not a master printer. But the language that floats between those, I have enough of a working knowledge after, you know, this, we'll say a few years of it, that I'm no longer stumbling over the physical aspects of it so that the idea and the image can pass through smoothly.
Yeah. I mean, is there a way in which maybe, like you said, okay, you're a decent photographer and not a master printmaker, but you have all of these other skills and experiences and proficiencies. Are there ways in which you think, like, okay, let's say you're making a photograph with the goal of making a print of that photograph. Are there ways in which being like good at photography and good at printing, but also being good at those 10 or 12 other things, maybe is actually an advantage or produces a different effect than if you were like just really amazing at photography and printmaking?
Yeah, I think the advantage is in the seeing. I mean, having a hands-on material understanding, like for photographing craftsmen, a lot of the craftsmen that I photographed, across the globe, they tend to make the same, they have the same complaints about journalists. That they will often ask them like, hey, do that again. And it's like, no, it's cut. Like, that's it. It's you, like, you kind of missed the window. That was it. And so they get a little frustrated not having someone understanding the process of what they're actually doing. So knowing how things get put together or taken apart, it allows, I know what I'm looking at. Like, I'm not just observing. If we go to the ballet, I have no clue what I'm looking at. I can't tell what's coming next. I only know things as they happen. And even when they did, I have no idea what they mean because I don't know anything about the ballet. But I can go into a workshop that's manufacturing a Japanese temple and like knowing the parts of the process, I have a good sense as to what I'm looking at and also what's coming next, like how these pieces are going to put themselves together. So I've always been fascinated in that creation process where you go from raw material to something else. I mean, in a few instances, it will go to something magical, but just even the point at which it stops being like a piece of wood and starts becoming a beam. Like, there's a moment where that shift happens and there's something that kind of defines that transition. And those moments of transition, if I wasn't familiar, I had been in those spaces when I didn't know what was going on and I missed most of it. And as I learned more about building specifically, I was like, oh, yeah, like now I know what I'm looking at. Now I've laid it out and designed it and sometimes put it together. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I think that makes a lot of sense. I think, you know, it's a more complex answer to like a really basic principle, which is like, if you're an artist, like you need to know your subject. Like it's really difficult to make good art about a thing that you don't understand or that you have no relationship to. And I think, you know, your cultural photography, which I'd love to discuss that term in a second, but your work about craftspeople, I think is so compelling specifically because it feels it's apparent to me in the photography that like you understand craft as a thing. And it's not, you're not a photojournalist who was just sent on assignment and told like, hey, there's this amazing knife maker, go take, you know, four pictures that we can run on page A6 of, you know, tomorrow's paper, right? Like it's a very different, much more immersive approach. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think I agree entirely, but I want to talk a little bit, you know, you kind of classify your photography practice as cultural photography, which is a term that I don't think gets talked about a lot. Can you tell us like what you mean by cultural photography and how it stands kind of in relation and opposition to other types of photography that people might know about?
So I got stuck in this position that I think a lot of creatives will empathize with, where You go to a party, someone says, hey, what do you do? Insert answer. And I had a really hard time explaining the work that I was doing. And people would say like, oh, like you're like a documentary maker. And the term just never really sat well, because the subject matter that I was engaging had like a little bit of architecture, a little bit of like religious philosophical belief practices, some still lives and some portraiture. So it was this weird genre blend. And I went and looked at science as a reference, because science is very good at classifying things, and they make wonderful little divisions and subsets. And I stumbled upon cultural anthropology, and I thought, oh, this is interesting. This is like a division of anthropology focusing on the cultural aspects of things, some of which you can see and some of which you can't. And a lot of the things that I found myself photographing with the Craftsman had to do with looking at how did a belief system of a culture or of an individual inform what it was that they would output, and acknowledging that some of the things you just can't see, but they have a real influence in the way that they do things. Like you can't see economy in terms of the way that someone handles material, but you can see the output and see that that is a very economic use of that material. But especially working with people who I don't always speak their language, I speak craft. Like I can go to places and found like Thai, Indian, Japanese, German, Italian. Like we don't have to be able to communicate linguistically, but seeing the way that they handle materials and make decisions, that portion of it is, that's a language. Like craftsmanship is a language globally. And I've seen craftsmen interact where they don't speak the same language. They might be, you know, Irish and Japanese, but they can deal with the object and understand that in a way. And Japan opened up an understanding of that that I hadn't expected. It taught me a lesson accidentally or non-intentionally, that at first just seemed to me like Japanese people being difficult. And it was, you know, when I, the first year that I went over, one of the knife makers who I was with, he's Japanese. His apprentice at the time was French, came from a blacksmithing family. And Eric, who was the apprentice, he spoke decent Japanese, but there was still, you know, there's a lot lost there. And the Japanese, for the most part, there is a bit of a tradition within apprenticeship of like not asking questions. You know, the juniors don't ask up. You watch. And if you have three juniors, the better observer is going to be the one who's going to advance. So the better you can see, which I think photographers can really relate to, the better they can see and watch and understand through their eyes, the further they will advance. And I thought, man, that is a brutal way to learn. Like, it'd be nice to just say like, that doesn't make any sense. Can you explain why did you do that way? And at first I thought it was in line with like a harsh discipline that there's a Zen backing to some of the practices that I've seen in Japan. But then what I realized was that eventually what happens is master of the shop dies. And if you're the apprentice and you are presented with an object, the same way that like an archaeologist might find something, you need to speak to that object. You need to understand how that thing can speak to you. And there's no one to ask. You have to be able to feel it, smell it, understand the material properties, so that in order for an inanimate object to speak to you, if you've been trained in making where you don't rely on questions, it's a tough education. But at the end, you're really good at having objects speak to you.
Yeah, that's a really interesting way to think about learning and to think about like knowledge transmission. You know, it's much more of a sort of like, I think it's very foreign to most of us. And I don't mean foreign in like it comes from a different country, but I think like so much of the way we're taught to learn is through asking questions. And it's a really like, there's a long Western tradition of sort of like dialectical learning through speaking. But this is a similar idea it's just through sort of different sensory encounters and with an object instead of a person. And I wonder to what degree your photography, I mean, you mentioned that there's so much that's like not spoken and not verbalized and like things about culture that are not seeable. To what degree is your photography trying to like bridge that gap and make those things seeable?
The aim with the photography is to make it like easily digestible. I don't have the artistic standpoint of art being difficult to take in. I mean, any of us who have ever been to a museum or a gallery and read that big thing on the side of the wall, or like gone up to a gallery counter and like read through the artist statement or the press release on the show and just thought like, what did I just read? And what does that have to do with anything on the wall? Like, I don't think it needs to be that confusing. It can actually, things can be very straightforward and easy to understand. And the photography got me out of the art school mentality where everything is like someone just threw up a thesaurus on a piece of paper. Yeah. And it's been like, hey, I made this thing. I think it's interesting. I've been working on it for a long time. Let's everyone go. Like, let's all come in. And the process with photography and with photo workshops was I would often get people who would say, like, I have no art background. I'm into it, but I haven't spent 20 years studying art, so I don't really know heads or tails. And I said, it's fine. We'll get you up to speed quickly, because there is some similarity with the watch community. It's like, when you have an educated community, it's fun. It's like, yeah. people get the references. They get all the work and all of the things that go into the world of it. All of a sudden, that language unpacks itself, and globally, it just expands in a way. Like, I'm sure you've gone to places and met people who you sit down, you've never met them, and you just find yourself in this like watch vortex, and you're like, how do we get here? 30 years ago, this wouldn't have happened.
Right. No, I agree 100%. And I mean, I think you're right. Like, the similarities between, you know, people who are into, you know, any sort of like niche thing, you know, and that can be a big niche or a small niche, but like whether you're into watches or photography or art or sculpture or craftsmanship or whatever, like if you find other people there is always that kind of like secret language that bonds people. Did you end up, I mean, like I said at the top of the show, like we met through the watch world at the beginning. Did you end up in watches through this love of craftsmanship, or did you come to it some other way?
The first thing that got me interested in watches was Dava Sobel's Longitude book.
That's a good way to get into watches.
I was house sitting for an ex-girlfriend at the time, and I picked up the book, and the thing that caught me at first was that Harrison was a woodworker. Mm-hmm. And when he was making his first versions of the H series, he used tropical woods, which have really high natural oil content. So they would be self-lubricating to some extent. Now, only a wood guy would know that. You'd have to know that like, Co and teak, like those tropical woods, which are a nightmare to cut. I mean, they're so infused with oil that the sawdust that comes off of them, it clumps. It doesn't even go up in the air. It's a very, like, cutting tropical woods is it's a weird tool destroying thing. So that was the first portion of the book where I thought, like, oh, this is kind of an interesting thing. And I've had a weird relationship with water for my entire life. And it struck me that, like, his ability to take, he was a woodworker. He was not an aristocrat. He did not have the backing to really go into this problem. But he was an innovative thinker and knew materials. And for him to go from a wooden model to, like, the H1, which I think was a 3x3x3 cube, by the time he gets to the H3 and we get almost a pocket watch, to me it was fascinating that, like, wow, the ocean in some ways made the watch. Like that material shift from land to water all of a sudden took this device, which you think about old clocks and towers, and like it motivated it to be this thing that was like in your hand. And I thought, wow, that was interesting. And then immediately looked them up and was like, oh, could never afford these. In fact, these aren't even selling. So the initial, you know, the initial buy into watches was this, it was his work that I found really interesting. It wasn't, I didn't have like a grandfather who had a watch that was this wasn't a thing. I only learned a few years ago that my father had, he bought a Seiko in Bermuda in like 1978 that he's had forever. He's just had it serviced this year and it's nice. The entire time. But I didn't like, it wasn't that like the grandfather narrative that a lot of people have, or the father narrative. It wasn't, for me, it was that book. That book was opened something up and has connected a thread through my interest in watchmaking almost ever since.
Yeah. I mean, you said you were also like, you've had this sort of obsession with the ocean. I mean, were you ever like, you know, staring at Cousteau's wrist or whatever and trying to figure out what was going on there? Or was that just not on your radar?
Only later.
Okay.
At first, the relationship, I was into the water and like particularly underwater because it was, when I say it, I had a strange relationship with water. When I was a kid, I crawled into a sump pump and drowned. So my initial, like I was terrified of water as a child. It was not like I had, like I saw the ocean, just loved it from day one.
That is a very casual way to tell that story.
Well, I was too young to remember it. My father revived me, but that was the early, like that was water from the beginning. So I didn't like lakes. I didn't like oceans, and then oceans worse than lakes because they had waves. And so It wasn't until I was probably like 7 or 8 when I learned that like you could go under a wave. Like before it broke, you could go under it. And we had a family friend who like took us in the water. And like I remember like going under and that feeling, that power of the wave, and then like passing through it. This was like there's a world up here and then there's a world here. And that's where like once that happened, I feel like people like fed Cousteau. Like they're like, oh, you like this, then check this out. And that's when it kind of picked in. It wasn't until much later with watches that I went back and rewatched Cousteau to see what Falco and Didi and Cousteau were wearing on the wrist to say like, oh, like you can see it, like it's right in the corner there. Like, so it's been a little circuitous, but that's where the relationship with the water started.
Okay. And then, you know, you read Longitude, right? And you're fascinated by Harrison. Like, where do you go from there? Like, how do you go from being interested in H3 to like putting a watch on your wrist?
That connected to Daniels. I think George Daniels was like the next historical step. And George was at the towards the end of his life. And from Daniels, it kind of went back to Breguet, and then got up to Jorn, and it was like, ooh, he's alive. Like that one we can find. And then there was a bit of a detour to Roger Smith. So it was in the people who made watches and who were dealing with time in a way that they approached it as a craftsman. I mean, Daniels was like, he was kind of an enigma in his early life. There's nothing about Daniels' early life that would have led anyone to believe he would have become the watchmaker he was in his later life. He was not like, he was a street kid. To some extent, from what I know of Jorn's background, like there's a bit of that too. Little like, you know, rebellious child, doesn't do quite well in school. And that's a narrative that I recognize from art. I mean, Caravaggio was a nightmare. I mean, he was an absolute nightmare. Michelangelo was terrible. Like these young teenage kids who had all this energy and all of this enthusiasm for making things, just they must have been unbearable to be around. And I'm sure there was something about that where I thought like, oh, well, these guys found a home, or they made a home for themselves in a way through the things that they made. And that appealed to me. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a really interesting way to think about it, that like there's almost, and I think watches, you know, have this in their own sort of like peculiar special way, but like if you can be in the watch world in some way, whether it's by being, you know, the the folks you've talked about, like some of the greatest watchmakers of all time, or in any number of other ways, like you can kind of make a home for yourself. Like this is a community and an industry that is sort of like supportive enough and small enough in certain ways that like it really can become its own universe.
Yeah, there was a line that, you know, the guy, Dave Hickey, he's an art historian.
Yeah.
Hickey was in a documentary on Warhol, a fantastic documentary that Rick Burns did. It's the brother of Ken.
Okay.
Ken's stuff's a little more known. But Hickey said that Warhol, who in watching the documentary, I initially had very little affinity for, but was like amazed by the end of it. Hickey said that Warhol understood that in America, you don't get up and lead. You move to the edge, declare at the center, and let the world reorganize around you. And that's kind of what Warhol did with the factory. And I think a lot of the outliers in art and in watches, I mean, in making, sometimes in eccentric sports that used to not be so mainstream, that you do that. And there's enough people now that support that, like, you go out to the periphery and all of a sudden there are a bunch of people who gravitate around you, and it gives a home for those outliers in a really, I think, in a much more survivable way than it might have been 100 or 200 years ago.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's an amazing quote. I'm going to have to go watch this documentary now. We'll link up in the show notes to it too, so that people can go find it. I mean, so you mentioned that when you were kind of following this path, when you got to Jorn, one of the things that was exciting to you was like, oh, he's alive. Like, I can go find this guy. You went and found him, right?
So I sort of. Fortunately, he was coming to New York. So I could go to the Jorn world is very small. And I found it to be like my sort of favorite collector base of people. Mm-hmm. And it's a group of the collectors in New York. They're absurdly knowledgeable. I mean, they've grown up with the brand, so they know it like nearly from inception. And they get excited when someone is into it. And the idea that like Jorn was still making, like that it wasn't done. Like I've really appreciated the way that he will continue to make things that sometimes in a commercial view, people think, oh, that doesn't make any sense. It's like, well, as an artist, there are loads of things you make that don't make sense, but in order to work through an idea, some of those ideas come to light.
Yeah.
It's slightly different where someone can like buy the piece of that. But I like that you can actually see him and his authorship working out the ideas over the years, where you see like details of dials, details of case design, the crowns, the movements, the assemblies. Like there are parts where you can see him like he's working on it. And then there'll be like a big jump forward, and some people, they'll love it. Other people won't. And to me, I don't really, it's not so much about liking it or not liking it. I just enjoy that that's happening and that we're able to see it work itself out. And he's not afraid to make, I would say a mistake, but he's not afraid to make something that somebody else might not like.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, Jorn sits at this really interesting point where, like, it's a brand, but it is a person. It's like, you know, a commercial entity. It's like a real company. They have, like, a small factory. But yet everything's still, like, pretty handmade, and it all feels like it very much comes from the mind of one man. And that's a tough balance to strike. I mean, like, on one hand, most watch brands are either, like, you know, Breguet, which makes amazing watches, Patek Philippe makes amazing watches, Vacheron Constantin, amazing watches, but like they're designed by committee, they're produced, you know, through the assemblage method, like it's not one guy or one small team making one thing. And then at the opposite end of the extreme, you have like, you know, Roger Smith and Kari Vuutilainen and like these like almost like auteurs in a certain way. Jorn to me kind of like does both at the same time. I don't know. Like, do you agree or where do you kind of stand on that?
I mean, my sense of it is that I encounter this more in building than I do in art, in that if you lay out a design for something. Like in the process where I'm in building, I will get information from an architect or an engineer. And then the crews who are going to be building it, I might not be doing like the physical labor. So when you have to translate a language from something like theoretical into something actual, there are ways that you can make it like very difficult for someone else to be able to repeat. I think what Jorn does an interesting job of doing is like knowing he might make 100 of these in a year. So there's a certain level of the design where it can't be so idiosyncratic that only you can do it. That's a manufacturing problem. And if you know, like for the really high end pieces, like, okay, he might have a heavy hand in a number of those because they are that much more complicated. But you can also design things in a way that you can lay something out for somebody and like a crew can go through and they can achieve that for what you need it to be. Like, not, I don't need an artisan to put together my toothbrush, you know, like for the thing that you need it to do or the enjoyment that you get out of it. There's a balance between like melting your own gold and polishing your own bridge. Like, you could spend your whole life melting gold bridges instead of actually producing watches that like make them. And that's, you know, Roger's got it at a different scale. Jorn's got it at a different scale. And artists, you have artists who have 40 assistants, artists who do everything themselves. So I think it takes a little trying to see like, what part, like when I wake up in the morning, am I tickled by? And what part am I like, oh God, like, dude, like, I don't want to polish another blade. Like, I want someone else I'm over that.
Yeah.
So I think
One of the things I wanted to talk to you about, because this is one of the questions I get from people more than maybe any other. I mean, it's definitely one of the top like five questions I get is are watches art or are they craft? And I think I know people who fall strongly on both sides, people who refuse to give an answer, people who say, oh, it's both, it's whatever. Like, where do you stand on that question? Is a watch a piece of art, or is it the production of craftsmanship, or is it neither? Is it something else entirely?
I mean, there might be some that are.
That are art.
That are, yeah.
Okay.
There's a small, if you try this, you might have to do this online. I don't know if you can do this anymore. There used to be paintings of salons from the 19th century and 18th century, probably even 17th century to some extent. So the painting would be of a bunch of people in a room with paintings around them, right?
Yeah.
So there were tons of paintings on the wall. Now, very few of those paintings on those walls are interesting. They're presented as art, but really they're like art production. Like, the vast majority of things that get produced, like, they're kind of like stage sets for art. You look at history, there are a handful that make it out that are really like art with the big capital obnoxious A. There are those. And then the rest is like, they're like art light or art-ish. Like, they look like art, but they don't really do the thing that art, they're not alive. That, like, that thing where a material assembly kind of lives over time and is alive to future generations, it's really quite hard to do that. So on the production side, like, it's not a distinction I make that often, because I'm not an art historian and I'm not a cultural designator. I don't anoint people. This is like what critics do, where they say like, you have done your thing so well, you make art. Like, that cape is art. I don't do the anointing thing. History does the anointing for you if it's any good. So it's a thing that, like, I don't get particularly bothered in. I find that there are watchmakers who are really interesting. They operate like artists in the way their studios run. I mean, Jorn at the beginning, he took in a bunch of commissions. He took in deposits and down payments on pieces he hadn't produced yet. This is not very different than how most artists in the 1500s and 1600s really worked.
Yeah.
Like, it functions. Well, yeah, a painting also has a sort of function if it works right. So it's not a distinction that I spend a huge amount of time like bludgeoning people over the head being like, that one, that's not art. Like, that, you can't have a car that's art. That's ridiculous. Like, I mean, yeah, sure, you could. It's hard. It's really hard. But you, like, you can.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder to what extent that answer, which I think is a great answer, is like a polite and more informative way to say, like, this is a stupid question to be asking. Like, this is not, like, to have that be the metric by which you measure something, good, bad, or indifferent. Like, it's just like, it's a bad yardstick, you know? Is that kind of how you feel about it?
I mean, it's like, what bookshelf are you going to put the book on? Like, does it go on the art bookshelf or does it go on the mechanics bookshelf? Right. Like, that's like the classification thing, where I think if you go into an artist's studio, like, you'll find it's just filled with books, and they're all like, the way in which they're arranged. I mean, here's, you talk about dysfunctional, like, my classification of the bookshelf is that's how I think.
I mean, that's, so for people listening who can't see this because we're on a Zoom call while we record this, Adam just pivoted his computer and his bookshelf is arranged by color.
So I don't care if you're art or not. I just remember, like, oh, you're an orange book. You're the good orange one.
Yeah. Hey, I mean, like, that I think is what makes, like, different artists and different craftspeople and different producers of all things interesting, right? Like, if we all thought about and classified things and looked at things the same way, like, we'd all be making the same things. Like, what makes, you know, we'll stick with Jorn here, what makes, like, a watch from FP Jorn so interesting is that it isn't built or conceived or thought of in the same way as any other watches, really. Like, even though he's deeply inspired by people like Breguet, like, it's, his watches are not new Breguet watches. They're watches from François-Paul Jorn.
Yeah, and they, I think one part of that question that might hold more attention for me personally, and it might not hold for other people, is that when making something mirrors back an understanding of life, this to me is very interesting. And I've found with makers that often the process in which they deal with materials, deal with creation, like the way they create things and the way they deal with the materials, they use their craft or their art as a way to develop a philosophy about their life. They understand the limitations of things. They understand how things last, how they wear out, how they break. There's sort of a, it's like a tactile quality with how you approach life, which when you go through an apprentice system or you make things in a workshop, not everyone does, but you have the opportunity to really extract a philosophical understanding as to how you would live from your work. And this differs from, like you'd mentioned earlier, that foreign concept. If someone slaps down an instruction manual and says, by the end of this class, like, you're going to know how to do this, like, it's given to you. A lot of craftsmanship doesn't, there aren't manuals per se. I mean, there are, George Daniels, when he wrote his book on watchmaking, was like, look, let me just save you a headache. The same way that Da Vinci wrote a treatise on painting. He's like, look, if you're going to deal with portraits, let me just give you a few pieces of advice up front. You're still going to make your own thing, but it's not really, it's a philosophical approach to how to do things so that you can answer your own whys. And that, I think, is where, like, kind of art in something is, like, if it's mechanically reproduced, Chevrolet is not making art. They're producing things. This is, yeah, not that, you know, I would, like, a Tesla doesn't strike me as art. I don't know. Maybe I haven't thought about it enough. It could be, but it's just like, this is a made thing.
Yeah.
And for me, I think that the kinship between people who make things is nice because we have similar headaches and we have similar success stories when finally, like, that thing you've been agonizing over for it could be, I mean, it could be a decade or two where you finally, like, I finally figured out how to create something in a way that it does this thing that I was kind of hoping it would do. And that's that is something I think, like, art echoing nature. Nature creates things all the time. It in wonderful, like wonderful relationships in an infinite, like variety. I mean, as an artist, you're dealing with like an absolutely minor, nearly non-functional slice of that. And that, like, I, that point I argued with teachers in university all the time. I was like, look, no matter what we make, nature's killed us.
Yeah.
Yeah, like just murdered us. It's like, not only is it better design, it's better engineering, it's better growth, it's got better longevity, it deals on like on multiple different time frames, and they all work next to each other. You can't have an art show with two students in the same white box without them trying to kill each other. Like, yeah, this is not successful at all.
Right. You bring up a really good point with all of this, which is all of these things are defined by like deep and I guess long developed ideas in many cases. And I know you have a, you know, particular interest in philosophy and specifically in Zen. Does that impact kind of how you engage with these things on a sort of day-to-day level?
Oh, for sure. I mean, there, I had no, I didn't have many templates. I didn't meet a functioning artist until I was in university, like someone who made their living from it. So the thing I wanted to do, in many ways, they were like unicorns. Like I'd seen them in books, but like I didn't actually meet any of them.
Right.
And my relationship with religious practice was, I mean, I grew up in a church. None of it made any sense to me. You know, I didn't do my confirmation. When confirmation time came, my mother was like, what do you want to do? I was like, well, what are the other options? Like, this one doesn't seem very good to me. So she's like, okay, I'll take you to meet, like, I was raised Presbyterian. She's like, well, I'll take you to meet like a Catholic priest and a rabbi. How about that? And I was like, okay. So I went. And at the end of that, I was like, I'm still not buying this. Yeah. So it struck me that like people believed in things, but how that all worked, it didn't really make any sense to me. So I ended up spending time more with Zen. I spent, you know, time with a guru in India to see those other aspects of believing in things, to try to come to some better understanding of like, how do you believe in something and why do you believe in it? And as a life path follow, you have to, I mean, you wake up in the morning, you pick a direction, you decide to do something, you decide to, you know, move in any way. The aim for me was for it to be fulfilling. And if there was no belief really underpinning it, it just seemed kind of random.
Yeah. So these ideas can obviously guide you in your life. That's obviously a much bigger conversation, but do you see these kind of like life defining ideas and these, you know, you say a direction, like having that sense of direction, is that something you see playing a deep role in both craftsmen and artists' lives? Is that a thing that in the sort of photography you're doing and your own artistic practice, do you think that's like a fundamental underpinning?
I think that after I've tried a bunch of things, like I've tried making work commercially. I've tried making work like commercially in an editorial aspect. I've done work for governments and private individuals. I ultimately finding a way to both produce things in something that doesn't feel like too repetitive or boilerplate is often something that like you have to make as the maker, you have to make a decision. Like, I'm going to do this. And I find that craftsmen often will like pick and choose. They're like, I don't want to do that. Like, yeah, maybe the money's good, but I'm not into it. It's like, it's not very engaging. And so depending on where someone's coming from, like for some people, like safety, security, and stability are really important. So if someone offers you 100 rotten commissions, but it pays well, you go and do that. For me, I was interested in the people who like, they had these weird lives where it's like, why would you do this? Like the knife maker in Japan, who I first started working with, he's in his late 70s. He's kind of step back from production to go learn how to make three new types of steel. Like he's a national treasure. He comes from a blacksmithing family who makes swords, knives, and scissors, depending on like what the condition of Japan was at the time, whether they were like fighting or doing Ikebana. He's like the top, you know, you sit down and have lunch with him and there's a sign behind him that says he's a national treasure. And he's like, yeah, I'm going to step back from this. There are these few other types of like, you know, steel manufacturing. He's like, I want to kind of go learn how to do this. Like he wants to start over again. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, that is amazing. There's the economics of that are absurd. Like looked through that lens, it's nuts. Plus he's also going to put himself a bit like back in the beginner's seat because he's going to have to go learn from somebody else. But he's interested in creating. Like once that filter is like shifted as to like, well, what are you doing here? You trying to be a national treasure? And he's like, yeah, I didn't try to do that. That happened. It's not as cool once you sort of get there. I still have to go. I mean, the Zen proverb where like before enlightenment, I carried water. After enlightenment, I carried water. It's like, you're still carrying water. So where's the fulfillment? What is the thing that somebody's really driving for? And not knowing how to like do that, not having people around me who I was like, well, why do you do that job? Like, why do you work on Wall Street? Or like, how come you're a doctor? Or like, why do you run a landscaping company? Like, I just didn't find answers locally that I thought they were very interesting. So I had to use many airplanes and boats and cars to track down someone to be like, why do you do that? Like, it's cool. It's great. You're famous. There's books and stuff on you. They run shows on you. But like, why do you mess about with that?
And so I'm going to ask you that question then. I think, you know, it's a perfect place to kind of end our conversation here is like, why do you do what you do? Like, what is it that motivates you through all of these different practices?
Understanding that creation process to me is endlessly fascinating and endlessly challenging. It has taught me more about myself and the world around me and gotten me into situations that otherwise I would have never gotten into. And the reward of seeing things at different levels has just made it from like growing up in a black and white television to like living in a hologram and being like, wow, this is so much richer than I had previously expected it to be. And I haven't seen any sign of it quitting. So that to me that's what's driven it forward.
That's perfect. I love that. I feel like, I mean, the hard thing here is like, I feel like we've just scratched the surface. I feel like there's so many other things we could chat about here, probably for like the next couple of hours. But yeah, dude, thank you so much for joining us. And it's really great to have you on the show. And hopefully the world gets a little less crazy and we can go make some pictures together sometime soon.
Thanks, man. Yeah, it was great fun. I can't wait. I can't wait to go outside and stand next to another human and do
it. It's going to be so good. Hopefully it's not that far off.
Well, it looks like we're getting there.
We're getting there slowly but surely. Awesome, man. Thank you so much.
Thanks again.
Take care.